how did we get to a point in this country where a decision was made to give 10 million children a novel and it looks like increasingly problematic medical product without anyone being responsible for thinking about the ethics?
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, Molly Kingsley, founder of Us For Them. We discuss vaccines for children, school closures, and the lack of accountability and ethics that pervaded government pandemic response.
I come out of this period feeling that much of what I thought about the British state was, if not a lie, certainly very hollow. I think the line between autocracy or dictatorship and democracy is much thinner than I ever possibly could have imagined.
Molly warns of a World Health Organization power grab and asks why the media isn't talking about excess deaths.
We are in this crazy situation where this is the emergency. It wasn't the pandemic. You know, we have a real crisis of fit young people dying and we don't know why. And we're kind of like...
Welcome to British Thought Leaders, I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm delighted to be sitting down with Molly Kingsley, founder of the campaign group Us For Them. Molly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You founded Us For Them just after the lockdowns first hit. Why did you start the organisation and what's its mission?
So we started it really out of a concern of our own kids. So there were only three of us when we first started and it was as simple as being really worried about the impact of what was by then 6 weeks of school closures on, you know, our kids who were at that point 4 years ago, which is unbelievable, but they were, you know, quite young kids. And we really, as parents, just saw in different ways that being out of school for such a long time was really not great for kids.
We've never really seen such lengthy and widespread school closures in modern times. Well, what kind of damage did it do to children? What do you think the long-term consequences are?
I mean, so we haven't seen lengthy school closures like that. And I think a really important point there is there have been illnesses, including pandemics, that were much more harmful to children. And yet school closures were not really in the policy makers' toolkit, and that was deliberate. And you know, I'm sure we'll come on to this, but it's not answering the question you asked. But the, you know, there's a bit of a myth, I think, developing, particularly if you look at what the COVID inquiry has been saying, that, you know, the possibility of school closures was always envisaged. That's a lie. It wasn't. And if you read the previous pandemic plans, particularly the flu pandemic framework, you know, to the extent school closures were envisaged at all, it was very limited, very localized school closures. So I think you're entirely right, Lee, this kind of blanket, indiscriminate and really very lengthy kind of school closure that we saw during the pandemic was unprecedented. I mean, in terms of damage, where do you start? And I think, you know, unfortunately, we are now seeing, and we have been seeing for 2 years now, some of the damage flow through. I mean, I think just last week there was yet another report about damage in terms of, you know, lost earnings. There was another one, I think, about speech and language. You know, so we now know that one in five primary children are not meeting targets for speech and language. You know, socialisation, child development, child health, actually. I mean, the other, I think, aspect of this that we were really, really worried about as parents, just with our own kids, is, you know, what happens to a child's state of mind, to his physical health, when you put them in front of a computer all day? You know, I remember quite early on during school closures, I think she would have been 7-year-old. And one morning, you know, my 7-year-old came out of a room, got her school bag, made herself a cup of tea and said, "I'm going to work now," and went and sat in front of a computer. And it was sort of funny, but it also really wasn't, because yeah, you're like, this is just not what childhood should ever have been about. And I think, I mean, you know, you... On the one level, you don't want to exaggerate the harm. Like, there's clearly many, many thousands of kids that will bounce back, will be fine. That awful "children are resilient" phrase undoubtedly is true for many children. But there are an awful lot of children whose lives will have been permanently derailed by school closures. We know that, and it's not an exaggeration. And, you know, whether that's because they're behind in core subjects, whether it's because they've fallen out of the school system altogether, and we know there are, you know, the last count, I think, over 100,000 children who are now off the school register, or whether they're just really behind in a very core discipline like speech and language. You know, how do you make that up when there also isn't the resource and attention being given to intervention? Because that's the other side of this. You know, we had school closures and we then didn't remedy the harm at a point when perhaps it could have been at least mitigated.
I mean, schools were closed not to protect the children as such, but as part of the wider policy to protect the elderly, really. Do you think the ministers who made that decision understood the harms that it would cause?
No, I mean, the whole thing was grossly unethical, wasn't it? And I think our concern as parents was just at the point we started, as for them, it was, you know, this is wrong. We don't ask children to burden their life to protect their elders. And unfortunately, you know, we knew from the very, very, or maybe not the very beginning, but we knew from very early on, we certainly knew from April 2020 that COVID was a very discriminatory disease in who was likely to be most at risk of serious illness and death. And we knew categorically that that was not children. I mean, it should have been a blessing that children were so rarely seriously affected by COVID. But we took that blessing and we turned it to a curse by still imposing these strictures on them.
So your excellent book is called The Accountability Deficit. Has anyone been held accountable for the damage to education that was caused during the pandemic?
No. I mean, they've all received knighthoods, haven't they? You know, it is, I mean, without wanting to give the punchline away, the book concludes that there is a stunning deficit of accountability, and, you know, not just in educational terms. So what happened to children's education was terrible. I think, and I'm sure we will come on to this, but, you know, I would say if you had to rank pandemic failures in terms of matters that require accountability, yeah, school closures, I would actually say, is almost one of the more forgivable errors. I think you can frame an argument that however awful the impact of school closures was on millions of children, there was perhaps a degree of honesty in the decision making, and, you know, I'm sure there'll be many people that disagree with that, but, you know, school closures were a terrible mistake. I am not sure they were, for want of a better word, a criminal mistake. I think there are elements of the pandemic response that, in my opinion, I'm choosing my words very carefully, border on, or in fact cross the Rubicon of criminal intention. I don't think you can say that for school closures, but no, to answer your question, these appalling, appalling mistakes that many of us, including many politicians, including the Education Select Committee, were screaming, certainly by the second round of school closures in January 21. So many people were saying this is going to be devastating to children. You know, you are doing this in the face of very uncertain benefits and known harms. And of course, the decision to close schools was, you know, proceeded with anyway, and it is a failing of our legislative framework that no one will be held accountable for the damage caused by that.
Another issue you look at in detail in your book is the vaccination of children. So, I mean, the government scientists did not want to roll out the vaccination to school children, but then the ministers did want to. Why would they want to overrule their own scientific advisers?
Well, that is a multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? And, you know, I think, we try and avoid speculation. I do not know. Obviously, there were vast sums of money at stake. So, you know, the order for the vaccines was put through end of 2020, I believe, and enough vaccines were bought by the UK government to ensure there were 6 doses for every man, woman and child in the country. So, you know, on one level, it is possible there was just this enormous purchase order. And that the key thing there is it was that purchase order was put through before the MHRA had actually approved the vaccine for paediatric use. So, you know, we'd stockpiled all these vaccines without there being people to vaccinate at this point. So, you know, it is possible, as simple as that, just a face-saving decision. I think, you know, I always feel like you're on slightly thin ice when you're talking about motives, because we don't know the motives as a ministers involved. What we do know is what we can see from the outside, that the decision to vaccinate kids was a unprecedentedly unorthodox procedural decision. We also, you know, as you say, Lee, it was made effectively overruling the advice of the government's own advisory board. Is the first way in which it was unorthodox. We also know it was made without any ethical input. So we know JCVI did not consider the ethics of that decision, and it appears that no one else did. I mean, that in itself, I sort of have to pinch myself and think, how did we get to a point in this country where a decision was made to give 10 million children a novel, and it looks like increasingly problematic medical product, without anyone being responsible for thinking about the ethics? You know, was that the right decision? Was it ethically legitimate? But apparently that's where we were. And I think the other way in which it was extremely controversial is just purely on did they need it? You know, was there enough clinical benefit to justify that decision? Now, of course, someone like Chris Whitty would say, and did say, there was. But actually, when you read the detail of, you know, the decision to override the JCVI, and then when you read the JCVI's decision for the younger age groups, it's very hard to construe benefit. And I think you get to a point where, and again, this won't be the right figure, but it's something like 4 million vaccine doses needed to be given to 2 million children to prevent a single ICU hospitalisation. It's something of that order of magnitude. So, you know, where was the benefit?
Tying this back to what we discussed before, children lost a lot of education hours because the schools were closed. So rather than open the schools, you know, the government decided to close the schools rather than open them. They tried to fix this by giving all the children a vaccination for a disease that's almost no threat to them. I can't understand how they came to that conclusion.
No, I mean, and this is, I think, the problem. The whole thing was so artificial. And, you know, when you looked at the decision of Whitty, when you looked at the decision of JCVI, because JCVI did recommend, for the younger age cohort, they made a non-urgent offer. So, again, very hedged decision. And I think no one could understand it, Lee. I mean, you know, I think we all looked at it and thought, what is this? Because, of course, on an ethical basis, you can't give children a drug unless the individual child benefits. Like, that is the ethical orthodoxy. And that ethical orthodoxy was ripped to shreds in front of our eyes. And unfortunately, what we're now seeing is the impact of that in terms of complete breakdown of trust in public health and the immunisation programmes that I think many people until 2020 would have considered A, essential, and B, totally uncontroversial. And, you know, of course, I'm thinking about things like the MMR vaccination, which we're now seeing increasing number of parents saying, oh, you know, I don't trust government anymore. Do I really want to give my child this? And thinking, I think, much more carefully about the risk-benefit equation.
Do you think this has done serious damage to parents' trust in government, healthcare, and, as you say, the vaccination scheme?
Yes, I mean, you can see that undoubtedly. And actually, one of the things that we did for the book was some polling on just that question, and the results were quite stark. I mean, the trust in public health, government public health advice, has been severely eroded. And actually, one of the things that came out from the polling data was that a significant proportion of parents did not know that the government had pushed ahead with the vaccination of children, you know, despite there being no recommendation from the JCVI. And of the parents that didn't know that, again, a significant proportion said, well, they wouldn't have done it had they known. Which, you know, again, it speaks to key ethical, so I keep going on about ethics, but, you know, ethics are important. I believe ethics are really important, and particularly things like informed consent when you're talking about what you do and don't give to your child. Like, there has to be informed consent. And I think what we saw during the pandemic was the, you know, undermining of key principles like that.
I just wanted to ask you about this concept of children overruling their parents to get the vaccine. So in the JCVI, government scientists say children shouldn't have the vaccine, and then a parent says, my child shouldn't have the vaccine, but a child could still choose, maybe they've seen it on TV or their friend has had it, to overrule all of those and get a vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was probably the moment when, I mean, certainly just speaking for myself, that I think was the moment that I became just fatally disillusioned with actually the British state, because I just thought, how dare you, you know, how dare you suggest, for, and it was young children, this is the thing, we weren't talking about 16 or 17 year olds, they were talking as low as 12, and it was, I believe it was Sajid Javid and Nadeem Sahawi, who at the time had toyed with writing to the children directly. I mean, this is how desperate these guys were. You know, whatever the motivation, they were desperate to think that it was acceptable to write to a 13 or 14 year old child and offer them a novel product. I mean, I'm going to be very careful what I say here, but that is just unequivocally wrong. And in fact, to be fair to them, they didn't in the end do it. They leaked their intention to do this, as all the least courageous ministers do, to the Daily Mail. And there was such a public outcry, they didn't do it. So in the end, that was all a bit of a fuss, I think, about, you know, a storm in a teacup that didn't actually happen. But it was, you know, even, frankly, even the suggestion of it in the UK, I think, was so sinister because it is just so unambiguously wrong. And I suspect, actually, that is probably more than any other the episode that has dented parental trust.
On this subject of ethics, I wanted to ask you about the MEAG, the Moral and Ethical Advisory Group. And could you give us an introduction to it?
Yeah, so actually, in the course of writing the book has a chapter on the vaccination of children. And I think because it did look so wrong and ethically suspect, we started doing a bit of digging. You know, what was the ethical framework here? Surely someone had considered the ethics. And we were actually tipped off to go and have a look at this group called MEAG, the Moral and Ethical Advisory Group. And this was a committee of 20 or so experts that had been set up in, as it happened actually, October 2019. So it wasn't a pandemic committee, but it was a governmental committee. By coincidence, I think the committee hadn't done much until the pandemic struck. But according to its terms of reference, its remit was to advise the government on ethical aspects of its decision making. And pandemic policy fell squarely within its remit. And there's a whole chapter on this book, so I will summarise. The group at the beginning of the pandemic started doing what it was meant to do and advising on the ethical aspects of the pandemic. And I think over the first few months, it's fair to say that they raised some concerns about certain aspects. In fact, going back to your very first question, one of those concerns was, have young people been taken into account enough in decisions like lockdown and school closures? But they weren't really screaming at this point. You know, these were just concerns being flagged. And the first moment of real note came in December 2020. And I should say here, actually, that all of this is documented in the meeting records. The meeting records are still online. So this is all, you know, minuted notes effectively of what happened, so all verifiable. And in December 2020, which was in the context of the COVID vaccine passport scheme, which, as you can, you know, probably remember, was very contentious. A lot of, you know, people in the public say, oh my God, you know, digital ID linked with this requirement to test or vaccinate, you know, this don't like this. And this, at that period, MEAG raised the first real or at least really serious concerns about government policy, and they put those concerns in writing and you know, set out, there was a paper that was submitted to DHSC and to ministers laying out really core ethical concerns with this plan. And then, as it happened, there was a Christmas break, and after the Christmas break, two things happen. The first is that the group reconvene and the chair of the group reports to the group that actually the chair has met with Chris Whitty, the CMO. Now, obviously, you know, Chris Whitty as CMO is the most important medical officer in the country. Yeah. Really, really senior individual. And Chris Whitty is, documented in the minutes. Chris Whitty has told the group to desist putting its recommendations in writing. So that's the first thing. And, you know, it, as lawyers, my background is a lawyer. One of my co-authors is also a lawyer. And we saw this written in the minutes and we just thought, what? This doesn't look as you would expect, you know, it to look, but carry on. Fast forward a few months, the relationship between this ethics committee, MEAG, and government, DHSC, and ministers, reading between the lines here, begins to look increasingly fractious. So they start being sidelined, the committee isn't called as often as it was called, and actually, whereas it had started being asked to consider, you know, a very broad remit, the topics it is asked to consider become narrower and narrower. So instead of, for example, look at the whole COVID vaccine pass scheme, you know, could you just look at very selected elements of it? I now know there's a term for that. It's called ethics washing. Oh, yeah. But this then really reaches its climax when in the summer of 2021, at the time the decision to vaccinate children is being made, MEAG let it be known that they think the vaccination of children is very much within their remit to advise, so they should be advising. And in fact, they circulate a paper to DHSC and to ministers, and this paper contains, again, very, very strong advice cautioning against the vaccination of children. So the polar opposite of what the government at this point are trying, you know, to convince everyone has to happen, and et cetera, et cetera. And what then happens is the day before the key meeting at which the vaccination of kids is due to be discussed, DHSC pull the plug on the meeting. Right. So that meeting never happens. And the result of that is, you know, the ethics of vaccinating kids are never considered by the UK government. And after that, MEAG is effectively sidelined and closed down altogether. So there are, I believe, only three meetings. MEAG was meant to run for another, I think it had an original three-year term, so it was meant to go to 2022. It's effectively disbanded a year or even a year and a half prematurely. And when MEAG convenes, some point in the autumn of 2021, you know, again, you have the pandemic response in full swing then, you have the vaccination of kids, you have vaccine passports, you have mandatory vaccination being considered, all these really contentious subjects that, you know, you would have thought an ethics committee was vital for, and they're not asked about any of that. And instead, they are sent off on what can only be described as tangents. So, you know, don't talk to us about ethics, we'll tell you what you should be advising on. And they only have three more meetings in that whole period, and they are about totally, well, at least to the external observer, you puzzle and you think, how are these subjects relevant in the context of this huge pandemic? And you know, to give you an example, one of the subjects is virginity testing, and one is the use of AI in medical imaging. So, you know, almost as if they were being sent on a diversion. And then the group is quietly disbanded, as in it's never asked to meet again into 2022. And when its term ends a year later, it's just let go. The coda to that is, and I should say, we spoke to two former members of MEAG in the course of writing the book who to verify key elements of this. And one of the things that emerged from that conversation is that since the group was, you know, effectively shut down or at least sidelined, the public perception of MEAG has been allowed to create an impression that actually there was this very active ethics committee. So it's been referred to in the COVID inquiry. There was certainly a ministerial reference to this ethics committee and it having played a major role in the pandemic. And, you know, one of the sources that we spoke to said that just, you know, that wasn't true. The role of it is being artificially inflated after the event.
So, as you mentioned, the JCVI said they weren't really including ethics as part of their strategy advice. And then this ethics committee is getting pushed out. Mm. So the only source of ethics left in the decision-making chain would be the politicians. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there's probably no ethical... I mean, specifically with the vaccination of kids, that was not a subject that needed a parliamentary vote. So, I mean, as it happened, there was a debate on it. And yeah, the politicians, a few of the politicians in particular, so Miriam Cates, Marcus Fish, there were, you know, were let their views be known that they didn't think this was right. But that's obviously a much less formal, even though it's Parliament, it's a Westminster, that was a Westminster Hall debate. It wasn't a vote. There was certainly no formal requirement for the politicians to take ethics into account. Mm-hmm. And then with some of the wider pandemic decisions, so COVID passes, mandatory vaccination of care home workers, yeah, once you've disbanded the ethics committee, you've got no mechanism for ethical input. And I think, you know, to the extent there has been a narrative at all about this, and I think ethics is something that we've really not talked about enough as a country, actually. I suspect because we got it absolutely wrong. And not only did we get it wrong as in, whoops, we forgot to consider the ethics, what it looks like, and, you know, if any minister or DHSC official disagrees with this, please do say, because, you know, we are only going on what is publicly available. But what it looks like from the publicly available records is not only that we forgot about the ethics, but that somewhere along the line, senior officials or ministers took an active decision to circumvent ethics, which, you know, I'm sure I don't need to spell out the implications of that. And actually, one interesting addition to that is obviously we've been talking about MEAG, the Moral and Ethical Advisory Group. Well, there was a very interesting article that's just been published talking about the Ethics Advisory Board of the NHS Test and Trace app, where, believe it or not, it looks like a very similar thing happened. So there was an Ethics Advisory Board for this Test and Trace NHS programme, and the Ethics Advisory Board into the, you know, partway into 2020 started giving inconvenient advice, at which point the board was sidelined. So, you know, you have a pattern of behaviour here of disrespect of ethical input, and I think that is a deeply, deeply problematic proposition.
The COVID inquiry is set up to look into the response to and the impact of the pandemic. Is it looking at issues such as this?
No.
Do you think it's playing any kind of decent, positive role at all? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is playing a it's doing some good in that it is at least forcing disclosure. So, of course, one of the problems here is, you know, how do you force disclosure of some of these issues? So short of taking ministers or departments to court, and, you know, we have tried that a few times, you can't. So, you know, the FO, I mean, we must have submitted hundreds of FOIs by now, tens at least anyway, and invariably they get stonewalled, you know, government relies on exemptions. It's very, very difficult to extract meaningful information from Freedom of Information Act requests. You know, litigation, you may force information out, but litigation is very expensive and is not something you want to enter into lightly, obviously. And the COVID inquiry at least has mandatory disclosure requirements. Now, of course, that can be frustrated when a minister deletes all of their WhatsApps. And that, you know, there's a separate issue there, actually, about the suitability of that technology for serious government business. But actually, even with, you know, despite ministers' best attempts to get round the disclosure requirements, we are seeing things flushed out that wouldn't otherwise be. So I think from that point of view, it has been useful. I think I find it incredible, however, that some of the issues that we uncovered in our book have not been thought about. So, of course, what the COVID inquiry might say to this and what they have said to us, so we feel very strongly about some of these issues, and we also feel very, very strong, you know, very strongly that governance is important, accountability is important, ethics is important, and there was just such flagrant disregard, or appeared to be, of many of these things during the pandemic. You kind of think, well, hang on, this has to be considered by the inquiry. And the proper module for that should have been, it seems, module 2, because that's the one that has just happened, and that was the module looking at high level decision making. So, you know, to take the ethics example, if you're not going to look at, you know, what happened to the ethics committee, if you're not going to look at that in module 2, well, when are you going to look at it? Now, what the COVID inquiry might say, particularly to the question of, is it looking at the harms associated with lockdown? Is it might say that's coming later. And in fact, that to an extent, that's what it has said to us. So particularly as regards children, it said, look, there'll be a separate children's module. We'll look at that later. I mean, you know, I think we would have an issue with that. So looking at it in 2026 or so, you know, 2027 is not that helpful. I think that the time we have a real issue, and I think there'll be many, many people who feel the same as this, is when you're talking about the vaccine harms. So as you probably know, that module has just been delayed, I think indefinitely. And I find that incredible. You know, at a time we have this excess death problem in the country, and at a time we know that is predominantly being fueled by cardiac and stroke events, both of which are known risk factors for the mRNA vaccine, how you can reach a conclusion that we're just going to kick that down the can for another year or 2 years, I don't know.
You mentioned WhatsApp. I think many people thought government ministers decide things by, you know, meeting in a wood-panelled room and discussing things. But what we've learned from all of this is a lot of it's done by, you know, sending WhatsApp messages to one another. It can't be a proper method for governance, can it?
If this was CEOs or directors of a corporate, they'd all have been fired. But I mean, it's just. So I used to be a corporate lawyer, and, you know, spent more hours of my career than I care to remember documenting meetings, minuting meetings. The thought that you wouldn't know that record keeping was important, the thought that you wouldn't know it was totally inappropriate to take cabinet meetings offline and create these, you know, side chat silos, defies belief. And in fact, I don't think they've even attempted to hide it. Do you remember that great exchange between Michael Gove and Matt Hancock? You know, what was it? What's the purpose of this meeting? To let everyone air concerns in a therapeutic environment before we go and decide the policy.
You are glowing.
You are glowing. You are glorious.
Glorious.
Kiss, kiss. There was no governance. At times, I don't think there was even the pretense of governance or an apology for the lack of it. And it would be, you know, if we were a functioning democracy, unfortunately, I don't think we are, we would have moved the conversation on now and we would be talking about accountability for that. What is the accountability for a senior minister who treats his fellow cabinet members actually like that? What is the accountability for a first minister who knowingly deletes all her WhatsApp records? But we, you know, that conversation, there's a disconnect. We all express horror when these things are revealed in the press, but the next day the story's moved on and no one seems willing to actually confront the fact that until we have meaningful accountability, by which I do mean, you know, civil and criminal penalties, this will just carry on. There's no incentive for these people to change. And that incentive has got to come from us. It's not going to come from government, but it could come from the people. But there is no incentive there's no impetus. There's no one forcing yet that conversation.
Looking at all these things that we've discussed, do you think that the pandemic time was kind of a glitch in the matrix and the governance went horribly wrong and things went very wrong? Or do you think it was actually a window into how things really are and we don't have the freedoms and the governance that we thought we did?
I think that's a really interesting question, actually. I mean, it certainly wasn't, I don't think, an aberration in an otherwise perfectly smooth running, democracy. I think, personally, I come out of this period feeling that much of what I thought about the British state was, if not a lie, certainly very hollow. I think the line between autocracy or dictatorship and democracy is much thinner than I ever possibly could have imagined. And I think we've got a lot of laws, a lot of statutes, a lot of regulations, a lot of committees, a lot of parliamentary time spent, you know, debating, questioning, running select committees. But actually, I think what I realise is none of that matters if you don't have accountability. You know, if actually we've got a lot of talking shops in this country and not enough action and not enough courage, actually, when people really do misbehave, as unfortunately it seems they do often and seriously. Was it an aberration? I mean, to an extent, yes, because it was an extreme situation, and I think the nature of the laws and interventions being proposed were quite extreme. But, you know, if the WHO Tedros get their way, that's not going to be an aberration. You know, living in a pandemic state of emergency will be our normal. And actually being locked down until we agree to take the next vaccine or we agree to be quarantined or tested, like, that is what these people, that or that particular organisation seem to be, you know, gearing up for. And I think until we correct what happened, until there is actually a conversation about, well, how do we correct course and how do we account for what happened, it won't be an aberration because it will just keep happening.
We also saw a window into how these big supranational organisations affect our lives. I think we weren't aware of before, particularly as you mentioned, the WHO, World Health Organization. Do you think people are waking up to that now? Do you think there'll be pushback against them taking more power?
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because I think we have a complete disconnect between what the press is reporting and the kind of issue that the press seems to be telling us is important to British voters. And actually what, you know, I don't know if it's a majority, it'd be interesting doing polling on it actually, but if it's not a majority, it's certainly a very vehement, significant minority of the British public see as a really existential issue actually. So yes, there clearly is pushback. I mean, you just have to look on, I mean, not only social media, actually, but to the extent articles on this issue go into the mainstream press, I think the comments are quite a good barometer of public opinion. And actually, it seems, you know, I'm quite surprised now, I'm quite reassured, actually, when I see comments to media articles and, you know, what you can glean from social media, there seems to be a really growing awareness that these organisations have perhaps overstepped some very fundamental line. You know, I do not think these are benign organisations, and I'm not suggesting there is a global conspiracy or malintent in the way we might recognise that personally. You know, I don't buy into this plan to you know, depopulate the world or whatever it is, and I don't even know how you'd go about improving intention. But I think when you have an organisation that has a significant financial motivation, you have to question whether that motivation is aligned with the public interest. And it seems very clear here that it isn't. And for me, that is malintent. You've got an organisation pushing a product that it stands to benefit financially from enormously. You know, we know the World Health Organization is funded 85% by the pharmaceutical industry. So for me, that alone should be enough to for the public to go, well, hang on, wait a second. Why on earth would we certainly agree to abide by anything this organization tells us to do? The interests are not aligned. You know, you wouldn't get that in business. It would be a clear conflict, or at least it would have to be declared and put on the table. And I think there's been a real lack of transparency from the World Health Organization about that.
People who are concerned about these issues, what do you think they can do?
They can force debate, actually, and we're seeing that. So I think, again, another petition on the World Health Organization has just hit the 100,000 mark, so there will be a debate in Parliament. I think at some point, quite soon, actually, debate isn't going to be enough. I think we're going to have to get active. You know, I know we all like being keyboard warriors and sitting behind desks, but, you know, as things currently stand on this particular issue, the time period for resistance is diminishing. So, you know, as things stand, there will be a vote in May 2024 on the at least one subset of the new pandemic arrangements. And actually, I know it's a bit old school, but protest. I mean, we're seeing in Europe now the power of protest with obviously the farmers. And actually, you know, I do think people are right when they say this is a power grab. It is. It's an affront to British democracy. And you know, not only in the mechanism to think that you could have this supranational agency imposed on Britain, but I think actually also in the substance of what it's saying. You know, there's nothing consistent with things like vaccine passports, things like lockdown, isolation, even frankly mandatory testing. These things are very at odds with, I think, what many of us would say are core British values of, you know, freedom, common sense, free speech we've not talked about, but, you know, the fact that WHO is saying, you know, it can censor wrong think effectively, I just find incredible. Like, we should just be telling them where to stick it. We shouldn't be engaging with the organisation in its current form. And I think people are beginning to wake up to that. I think an awful lot of noise is going to need to be made by an awful lot of people. And I think the one certainty here is that it's going to need to be the people, not, unfortunately, Parliament, who eventually stop this. Because, you know, we have a staggeringly weak Parliament, with a few politicians aside. But the ability of this Parliament to sleepwalk into, you know, handing over its sovereignty seems to be, you know, moving along unimpeded. And I'm dubious whether enough parliamentarians are going to feel alive to the issue in time.
On the topic of free speech, the counter disinformation unit was set up by the government to tackle domestic threats. It was used to target you and other public figures because you disagreed with the government narrative. How did you find out about that, and how did it feel?
Eventually, we found out when we submitted freedom of information requests, or actually subject access requests. So actually, sort of the exception to what I was saying before, the only time that kind of request has yielded dividends was this, where we asked, you know, what information was this unit? I think there must have been an original, one story had broken. I think it was the Big Brother Watch report had revealed there was this unit. And then I and others submitted requests. And I was really shocked when this list, huge pages long list, came back of everything that they had been monitoring. And
on you.
On me. And what that was, I mean, not everything I'd been saying, but it was a lot of what I'd said publicly since the end of 2020, really. And, you know, there were a few things that were noticeable about that. One was that what was picked up was manifestly not disinformation. So, you know, some of it was opinion, you know, schools should not be closed a second time kind of thing. Some of it was actually facts. It was anecdotal evidence from our parent network. You know, parents are distraught about having their kids masked again. I mean, you know, in what world is that disinformation? God only knows. And the other thing, which now we've done a lot more research on, it makes sense, is it seemed to step up in intensity with our opposition to the rollout of the vaccine for kids. So it wasn't exclusively that, but it was quite largely that, I would say. You know, in terms of how it felt, I think by the time it came out, I probably wasn't surprised. And if anything, it was a bit of a relief. I think the period that had been really upsetting was during sort of the beginning of 2021, when it all felt like it was getting very dark in ways I can't really explain now. But, you know, we kept having sort of blocks put on our social media accounts or warnings slapped over them. It was very obvious to me for quite a long period, social media posts seemed to be very suppressed. So either things didn't get traction, or then for quite a long period, things would get an awful lot of traction. So tweets would be retweeted, you know, hundreds, sometimes thousands of times, but follower numbers would never grow. And you just saw, the odd thing, I mean, you probably know the way Twitter works, but you can see followers being added. So you can see, well, hang on, you know, our Us For Them account or my account has gained 200 followers today, but the number always stays the same. How's I think at the same time, it became very noticeable that we were being commissioned less in mainstream press. So I think a lot of the focus, certainly in mainstream press, about the CDU, the Counter Disinformation Unit, has been how it works with and how it interacts with social media to suppress certain narratives and amplify others. I think there is a really significant question about the extent to which the CDU and ministers also were working with press. Right. So I'll just leave that hanging there.
What does this say about our society when a government's using these advanced psyops techniques to, you know, target people like you who are saying don't close schools?
Yeah, we've gone a bit wrong, I think. I mean, you know, I'm not saying, of course I'm not, that I or Us For Them were right about everything, although I think we were about quite a lot of things. But, you know, we certainly had valid opinions that should have been heard. And actually, more than that, we had and have opinions which were informed by thousands of parents. So, you know, we were not a non-representative organisation in that respect. And I think when you know, what's that old adage, when you're trying to censor information, it's not the information that's wrong, it's, you know, it's what you're trying to do. Like, the reason why do you feel we're such a threat? It's because the policy is wrong. You know, we're criticising bad policy. And instead of having a debate about that policy, we were censored. And I think, you know, we're really, really seeing it now. And, you know, people talk about this like it's all over. It's not all over. I think although some of the censorship activity of government has been flushed out, and I believe certain units shut down or at least transferred, I'm pretty sure that we have discovered only us, Big Brother Watch, sort of various newspapers that have exposed some of this. will have exposed only a fraction of what happened. We've got no reason to think it's not going on. And in fact, if you look at what the World Health Organization have said, you know, it is still going on and the plan is to amplify it. So I think we're still in this period. And I think, you know, the sharpest end of that, excuse the pun, is very much what is happening with the conversation around vaccine harm and excess deaths. You know, on any measure, that the excess death figures are worrying enough to merit mainstream coverage, serious mainstream coverage. You know, these are lives. These are lives of young people that are being, at the moment, inexplicably lost. Now, it may or may not be the vaccine, who knows? But surely you have to have the conversation to be able to flesh out whether it is. And I think what we are seeing is, you know, we have made that subject taboo. Partly that will be self-censorship. There will be a nervousness about touching on it. But you can bet your bottom dollar it's not just self-censorship. I mean, you know, many of these media organisations take money from the same people the World Health Organization takes money from and are conflicted. And, it's why what you're doing and people like you is so important, because we are in this crazy situation where this is the emergency. It wasn't the pandemic. You know, we have a real crisis of fit young people dying and we don't know why. And we're kind of like going like this, and that's just so wrong, isn't it? And we also have got, you know, we have got ourselves into a position where we appear to, at least during the pandemic period, have normalized or tolerated, you know, government without ethics. And, you know, how do we think that's going to work out?
One final issue I wanted to ask you about, I think our viewers would forgive me if I don't, is the role of smartphones in our children's lives. I know you're running a campaign on this. Can you tell us what you're campaigning for and why?
Yeah, so our campaign is safescreens.org, and it's a separate website, actually, because predominantly because we wanted to host it away from the COVID stuff, although it is, you know, I think it is one legacy, actually, back to your very first question. It's a legacy of the pandemic and school closures that we attempted as a society to move children's lives onto screens. And unfortunately, we were quite successful. So, you know, I think many horrible statistics on this. And, you know, it's in a way it's awful to distill it down to statistics. But, 91% of our 11-year-olds own a smartphone. And now, according to Ofcom figures, they spend over 4 hours a day on that device. And, you know, what are we trying to do? We're trying to stop that. Why are we trying to do that? Because you are just not going to convince me that, you know, or any of us as parents, that a future where our kids are spending so much time peering into these tiny little screens and away from learning, books, friends, football, cricket, you know, whatever it is, away from life, away from childhood, that just can't be right. And, you know, we're seeing the impact of that, of course, in children's physical and mental health. And I think, you know, the other thing about this is I think we're seeing it in terms of impact on our society. Like, we are becoming a zombie nation. I mean, even just walking here down from Victoria, I was, you know, as I always am whenever I'm in London, just sort of shocked at how many people are just, you know, walk with their phones like this. And it's, you know, it's not just our kids, is it? But I think the, going back to the ethics of it, I think the argument is clearer with children, because, you know, the phone companies really are monetizing our children's childhood. And that's just wrong. You know, the kids don't stand to gain from this. The kids are becoming unhealthier and unhappier with every passing month. And the tech companies are getting richer and bolder. And what the campaign calls for is effectively tobacco-style regulation of smartphones. Various reasons why we've hit on smartphones, not just social media, but the key thing would be that, you know, unless the phone can be shown to be safe for children, it should not be supplied to them. And that should not be a controversial proposition. Like, generally, we don't give our kids dangerous products, and the smartphone in its current format is dangerous. It is addictive by design, and it contains a whole load of apps which, you know, in themselves are problematic. So social media obviously gets most of the attention here, but also all the gamification apps. And I think what we're not saying, the campaign's been a bit misrepresented, and, you know, bits of the press. What we're not saying is kids can never have phones. Clearly, kids can have phones. Ideally, and like this would be a message to Nokia or, you know, a phone company, there is such a gap in the market here for a product that isn't a brick phone. So it's a little bit more than a brick phone, but a lot less than a smartphone. So why can't we have a phone that has the ability to text, to call, that has GPRS, you know, maybe very limited app functionality, train timetables, banking apps? I think we could all agree that would be okay for kids and probably quite helpful. But the product in its current form is not helpful. It's dangerous. And we're saying, whilst it's dangerous, it needs to be taken off the market for kids. And actually for adults, let's slap big warning signs on it. Let's not call it a smartphone, let's call it what it is, a dangerous device that should come with a health warning for us as much as our children.
Molly Kingsley, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.